Welcome to The Property Wizard. If you are brand new to the real estate investment world or have limited experience, you've come to the right place. Freddie Crouch has over 35 years of real estate investing experience. He's seen it all, and he's ready to share it with you. This podcast takes an inside look at investing in real estate, what to look for, and most of all, how to move forward. Please welcome the property wizard, Freddie.
Welcome back, everybody. Once again, I'd like to thank Nathan Simon for that great tune. Never get tired of listening to it. Nathan is part of the team at Carl Speaks, which is headed up by no other than podcast guru Carl Richards. To round off the team, cover artwork is being provided by Carolyn Nikolai. Thank you, everyone, for that wonderful effort. So, Bernie, recap from our previous podcast on appraising your property with our guest, Terry Egan. Any questions, comments, anything at all, Bernie?
Usually you think about an appraisal as like, how much is that puppy in the window worth, right? But it's a lot deeper meaning in this. There's a whole bunch of things that can be influenced. If the market is hyperactive and not truly reflective on a value, that makes it hard to provide an evaluation unless, of course, it stabilizes. And then, you know, the bank then decides, or the mortgage lending institution decides whether to give you money based on that. And, you know, this also feeds right into insurance. You know, what is it worth to rebuild? You know, how much does it cost? And that's all about appraisal.
Terry spent a little bit of time on that, just about replacement cost and, you know, how it's more relevant for newer homes or new construction versus older, because there's a lot of objectivity involved, or you'd like to try to be objective, but at the end of the day, how much time or how is it possible to decide, okay, if the roof has a 25-year life expectancy, you've got 10 years left. I mean, without really doing something, you know, extremely detailed. But at the end of the day, you're right. It's boiling down and becoming a fine science. And it's not an easy task or position to be in. You know, and lenders need to be protected, and the appraiser constantly needs to be reminded who their client is. So at the end of the day, it was really interesting to hear what Terry had to say. So anyways, not necessarily a field I think I'd want to dip my toes in these days, for sure. You've got mail. Tell me, I know we did a few questions last time. Did anything else happen to pop in, Bernie?
We have one here right now from Michael. My lending institution is asking me to have a building survey conducted on a mixed-use building that we just purchased. Can you explain to me what a building survey is and why I would need one?
That's a great question, Michael. Thank you for that. First, let's answer the question of what a building survey is. A building survey is a report on the status, including the remaining life expectancy, which speaks to my comments regarding our previous podcast on appraisals. But it's a report on the status, including the remaining life expectancy of various components of a structure, such as a roof, building envelope, the heating system, whether it's a boiler or HVAC, elevators, windows, doors. I mean, it encompasses all these major components and others too. This is by no means a comprehensive list. Why would your lending institution ask for one? Well, primarily, they may want to make certain that you have made sufficient allowances for a reserve to replace these components. Or your lender may insist that you put a certain amount of way and show proof thereof to assure that the money will exist when the component needs to be replaced. So again, a building survey is different than a building location survey. A lot of people, when they hear the term survey, they immediately think it's a drawing that basically outlines the lot that the building is on. And a building location survey will show the location of the building on that lot. Well, that's true. That is a survey. But a building survey is different. We're talking about breaking down the components, all the elements of the structure. And we're talking about evaluating the remaining life expectancy in order to assure that the property owner, management company, whoever is administering the property, is putting away adequate funds to replace those components as they come up. If you've ever owned a condominium, for instance, you've probably heard of a reserve fund study. A reserve fund study does just that. Now, in that particular case, they are required by statute to have a proper, for lack of a better word, like a building survey done on all the components of the condominium. And they are required to make sure that every owner or participant in that condominium contributes an amount of money to offset or eventually pay for that component. It's essentially the same thing. One is building specific and is usually used and required of commercial lenders in commercial buildings or mixed use structures. The other one is for condominiums. They're two separate issues altogether. I don't want to confuse our listeners, but remember, a building survey is specific to a building. A building location survey is specific to the lot and shows the location of those buildings on the site plan. Thank you very much for the question.
If anybody has any questions, send your emails to info@gentryres.com. That's info@gentry, GENTRYRES, all one word, .com.
From the current events desk of the Property Wizard, it's news of the week.
So, good listeners, I have a couple of short articles here that I've pulled off the web. Again, regarding the issue of property density. They're from a couple of different sources, but it's something for you to keep in mind, and it may open your eyes to other opportunities out there, opportunities that can solve the housing availability crisis, as a number of municipal politicians refer to it as. And there's no doubt that there is a lack of affordable housing in not just the Eastern Ontario region, but right across the country and throughout North America. So I pulled an interesting article that's entitled Los Angeles Used Small Lot Rules to Get Stealth Density into Its Housing-Starved City. Could Toronto do the same? Well, what on earth is stealth density? I thought, what an amazing term. I need to find out a little more about that. So essentially, let me paint the picture for you. There's an area in LA, which is used as the example here, called Echo Park. And in Echo Park, 5 lots were split into 18 and filled with duplexes and triplexes that look like single family homes. So this is really interesting because if you were listening to our last podcast, I spent a little bit of time speaking or talking about NIMBYism, not in our backyardism. Now, what they've done to address it in this case is they've taken a series of lots, combined them, and created a little community. And each one of these, they look like single family homes, in some cases, very nice single family homes. But each one of these homes has 2 or 3 units in it. And I thought, wow, okay, that's a brilliant idea. And that, for every reason you can think of, is a wonderful solution to those who aren't interested in seeing a new development or a newer type development or a higher density development in their neighborhoods. So if the outside of the property looks just like any other property in and around the area, but the insides are different, well, that's something they call stealth density. So remember that term, because I think we're going to hear a lot more of it. So I just highlighted a few things. The name of the project was The Blackbirds, and it was a project designed by Los Angeles firm Bestor Architecture for a developer called Local Construct. Echo Park is a residential community in central LA. It was built around 2011 on 5 lots, totaling 0.82 acres. So it's not a huge piece of property, but it's amazing what they were able to do with it. So it was built on 5 lots totaling 0.82 acres that were combined. Now, there's a further note here that some of the lots were empty. There were a couple of dilapidated homes on some lots, and one lot had a small single-family home from the 1920s. To make room for the Blackbirds, the properties were divided to create lots for 18 houses, a mixture of duplexes and triplexes that from the exterior looked like large single-family homes. The houses were 2 and 3 bedrooms and range in size from about 1,360 square feet to 1,930 square feet. So essentially, the roof lines, it goes on to comment that the roof lines make the structures look like one large single family home, where in fact there are two or three homes in that structure. This is an element of the design that Best Tor, again, the architectural firm, refers to as stealth density. So developers, future developers out there, property investors, think of that next time you take a look at an infill project. You know, one of the biggest naysayers or one of the biggest obstacles any developer has when there's an intensification project are what the neighbors are going to think. Well, the neighbors are going to have a hell of a lot less to worry and comment about if the exterior of the structure looks like every other home in the neighborhood. So keep that in mind. Now, looking at another aspect of the lack of affordable housing, or a different aspect altogether, and something we haven't spoken about much at all, is from another article, a CBC News article that was posted January 3rd of this year by Rachel Bergen. And I'm just going to read a little bit from the article. But again, this is actually something quite interesting. At the age of 74, Frances Wilson and her husband, Jim, have finally bought their first dream home in Winnipeg's Crescent Wood neighborhood with the help of five strangers. Now, this is different than a co-tenancy arrangement that I, you know, you hear me constantly talking about when we're investing in property. This is more of a cooperative venture where a group of people that don't necessarily know each other are actually buying a home and living together. They are now the proud owners of an approximately 5,400 square foot three-story home. The residents range in age from 39 to 78 and share everything from food to chores to downtime. The intentional community began as a way to combat seclusion during the pandemic, especially among seniors. So there we go. Here's another viable solution or alternative to intensification. Taking an existing home and again, making or having it occupied by a group of like-minded individuals. And in this particular case, what's beautiful about this is they don't necessarily know each other. There's a husband and wife and three additional strangers who have taken over a rather large residence and are living together. So without really getting into the details, it sounds to me like we could have an entire show about just this topic on its own. It goes on to say that the house is owned by the co-op, and those who want to join the co-housing community purchase a share in the co-op, which, according to their website, currently costs $200,000. So you've got a group of people that have pooled the resources, many of whom are coming from single-family homes, and are moving into a co-op living arrangement. They also pay monthly expenses, which can be compared to condo fees, and include, among other things, taxes, the internet, and the phone. So how's that for thinking outside the box? Now, here's another viable alternative. So I think both of those are really, really interesting developments in the real estate world. And as investors, we should keep these opportunities in mind. So it is with great pleasure that I am tasked with introducing Thomas D. Watson Jr. to our podcast. Hi, Thomas. How are you?
Fantastic. How are you doing today?
Well, we're doing just great. Just great. I had a good friend of mine who Bernie and I knew quite well, Ernie, who used to tell me that, you know, if he got up in the morning and stretched his arms out and he didn't hit wood, it was going to be a great day.
That's my definition of a successful day. Every day you wake up, going to be a good day.
There you go. So Thomas is a third generation insurance broker and also a reserve officer in the Canadian Armed Forces. He's also an ordained minister, and he's officiated over 200 weddings in the last 3 years. Wow, isn't that something else? Now, did you come by that honestly, or is that something you just kind of fell into after doing a favor to a friend?
So I come by it honestly. I actually have 2 degrees from St. Paul University in Ottawa. I've got a bachelor's degree and I've got a master's degree in religious education. So that's what I do to keep myself busy and out of trouble on the weekends.
Well, there you go. That's wonderful. I can think of many worse things to do. That's a beautiful story. That's really nice. Thomas also provides high quality, personalized personal and business insurance services to clients looking for someone who doesn't treat them just as a number. And so many people out there are guilty of just that. And sounds to me you've got the right cut to give our listeners exactly what they need to hear. His company has a full service personal and small business insurance section. And let's take this time to welcome Thomas to the show. Welcome, Thomas. So let's get right into some questions here, because in the preamble, which many of our listeners didn't listen to, a lot of these questions can get really complicated. So, Thomas, let's try to keep it simple but informative.
Absolutely. So
the first question that I have for you is, in today's environment, are we correct in the belief that there is no guarantee that insurance on a property is easy to obtain? I remember the time when it was nothing more than a phone call. It was really simple to do, but I've heard a few stories about, you know, conditions and closings actually having to be extended because of the inability of the buyers to arrange for insurance. So is that true?
Absolutely, it's true. Particularly today, we're in what we call a hard market in the insurance industry. It means insurance companies are being much more selective on what they're willing to insure and much more pricey than what we've seen in the past. So everything's insurable, right? I can insure anything. Every insurance broker I've talked to, we can get you insurance, but the terms, the conditions, the price, and how long it's going to take us to find a company willing to do it, it's not like it was 3 years ago where you're right, someone would phone me at 3 o'clock and by five, I could have them commercial insurance. Now, half the time I can get it done that quickly. The other half of the time can take up to 30 days for us to find an insurer who's willing to take the risk.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. Bernie.
Thomas, based on all that, when's the best time for someone who is buying or investing? When should they be reaching out to the broker to get the coverage?
Depends on the individual investor's tolerance. If you're the type of investor that doesn't care about how much it's going to cost, you buy the property, phone your insurance guy, we'll find you something, you pay the bill, you move on. But if you want to go into something deliberately and have an idea of what you're looking at, an idea if you can make money on the property, your best bet's to contact an insurance broker as soon as you start looking at it. So if you see a listing, you go, you know what, I think I might want to invest in that property. Call your insurance broker and say, hey, I'm thinking of buying this. What's the problem? And, you know, most of us out there, we can take a look at a property, look at a listing. We can let you know, not necessarily where the problems are, but what the questions that the insurance companies are going to have are going to be, so that when we go to them with your property, we've got all of the answers. We can be upfront. We can say, look, you know, yes, this is an older building. It's got a galvanized steel plumbing system, but we know what's going to be taken out in the first 30 days, that type of thing. So we can start making that plan and starting our negotiations. I always tell my clients, the more time you give me to do my job, the better the finished product is going to be, right? Because if I've got time, then we've got a chance to find the problems, address a plan to fix the problems either prior to closing or quickly after closing and get the best possible terms available. But yeah, the more you have in terms of information when you go to your broker, the easier it is for them to do their job.
Wonderful. Great. So could you describe to our listeners the circumstances under which a building could not be insured?
I actually have one right now I'm working on. A gentleman's attempting to purchase a commercial building. It's an older warehouse. And the problem we're having with that is he has 6 first mortgages. So, and it's not like the traditional syndicated mortgage where you've got a MIC who's doing the first mortgage with 6 investors in the MIC. We've got 6 individuals that want to be listed as first mortgagees on the policy, and we're not having any luck finding an insurer willing to do that.
Wow. Is it a pooled mortgage? Is that the idea?
Yeah, it's a pooled mortgage, but the way they're structuring it on the financing side doesn't work with the way the insurance companies are willing to look at things, because they don't want to be dealing with 6 first mortgages. They want to be dealing with a single point of contact.
See, that is a classic example and reason why you want to have what's called a co-tenancy agreement. You can lend somebody the money, but what you do is you lend it through a single entity, a corporation. And that essentially is what you're doing when you enter into a co-tenancy agreement. You can turn around and break down the shares and everyone can contribute a certain amount, but you add a party to the transaction. You add a party, the entity, the group, the co-tenancy group, so that it's represented by a single person. Because the other complication that arises by what these individuals are trying to do is a question of banking as well. You know, what they're doing, they just, in all due respect, I don't know the parties at all for the record, but this is a classic example where a co-tenancy agreement should have been inserted or should be inserted. That way, the insurance company is dealing with a entity, one, that are all protected by the conditions contained in the co-tenancy agreement. That's what we do when we're taking a look at a property where there's multiple owners, or a mortgage where there's multiple investors involved. You're dealing with one. So I think that would probably resolve or solve the issue that these
would folks are solve under. The problem in 30 seconds if those six people would form a mortgage investment corporation, give their money to a mortgage investment corporation, anything where we're down to just one first mortgage.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't have to even be a standard mortgage company or a standard lender. It just has to be one entity.
Just one entity. That's right. And that's the way, you know, we look at these things. What you're doing is when you enter into a co-tenancy agreement is that you're actually lending the company, the new entity, the money. That's what you're doing. So what you receive back from the new entity is a promissory note for the amount of money that you've invested in it. So it's a perfect workaround. Like it is. Really, these folks need to revisit this. What I suggest respectfully is you could pass that off to them. It's not complicated at all. And we've done so many of them, but it resolves the issue. I feel it would resolve the issue you've so aptly stated. So that's tremendous. Are there any other real hands-off situations? What happens, Thomas, for instance, if the property is obviously contaminated? Can we get an insurance company to bind that?
Generally, yes, but it'll be very restrictive coverage and there'll be a lot of conditions attached to it. Usually, if that's the case, the insurance company would want to exclude pollution because we know it's already contaminated. We're not going to insure you for something that's already occurred. When it comes to things like that, I like to think, you know, the knob and tube wiring, the really old plumbing, things like that. Generally, we can go to a specialized market who will do a short-term policy so that we can get the coverage, you can close the deal, get into the building, and then immediately gut it, do all the work you have to do, get it to an acceptable standard, and then we rewrite it to a standard insurer. So there are companies that exist to insure the questionable properties. Again, there's nothing wrong with the properties. They're just old. Maybe they haven't been maintained, particularly on the residential side. You get someone, they bought the house new in 1960. They've lived there their entire lives. They haven't done any updates to it. It's going to be more difficult to insure because there's just stuff that was done in the 60s now that we know was a really bad idea at the time.
Do you want to start investing in real estate but just don't know how or where to start? Then Real Estate Investment, The Essentials, is the course for you. This interactive digital course takes you step by step through the process, from determining what kind of real estate investor you may be to raising investment dollars and assessing opportunities. Why wait? For a limited time, you can save $250. Just enter the coupon code podcast at checkout. Visit gentrylearning.com to start your journey towards financial security and independence.
So there we go. Bernie.
What items does an insurance company look for when deciding whether to, we're going to insure them, no, we're not, or there's a lot of words, caveats?
So generally, when we're looking at properties, we use an acronym called COPE, C-O-P-E. It stands for Construction, Occupancy, Protection, and Exposures. So we want to know, what's the building made out of? What are the updates? How are we using the building? Is it a commercial building? If it's a commercial building, what's the occupancy? You know, is it a corner store, a liquor store, a dentist office, a lawyer's office, that type of thing? Protection is, what do we have for fire protection, water protection? So do we have sprinklers? Do we have fire alarms? How far from the fire hydrant? How far from the fire hall? And then our exposures are things outside of the building that could cause problems. So you're buying a nice commercial building downtown, but it's right next to a higher risk building. So maybe it's an older building that hasn't been maintained, or maybe you're in a higher crime neighborhood, or you're in a neighborhood that's 6 inches above the Ottawa River in terms of height. That's the type of external exposures that could have negative impacts on the property. So we look at those things, and that's what we use to determine pricing of a property policy and the conditions that we're willing to insure it, right? So, and this shouldn't surprise anyone, but you buy a house on the Ottawa River, we're probably not going to give you overland water coverage because it's more of a certainty that that house is going to flood. And insurance is not about protecting you from things we know are going to happen. We want to protect you from the unexpected things. Insurance is not a maintenance plan. If it's something that we're expecting is going to happen, we're probably not going to insure for it. Right? If your roof is old and falls apart because it's old, well, that's bad homeownership. If you lose your roof in a windstorm, that tornado we had a few years ago, that's fine. You can't plan for a tornado. So yes, we're going to replace your roof. So if there's one thing people can think of, particularly people buying investment properties, be prepared to pay for maintenance yourself. Don't expect your insurance company to step in and do it for you.
I have a question here having to do with annual inspections. Are annual inspections required of certain properties in order for insurance to be maintained? We have some listeners that have had commercial policies where it seems like almost on a biannual basis, they're being asked or the insurance company is asking to come by to inspect the property. Is that fairly commonplace, Thomas?
Absolutely, particularly in residential realty. So rental properties, things like that, insurance companies are wanting those inspected to make sure they're in good repair, to make sure there's no illegal activity going on. I had a client had a rental property. Unfortunately, his tenant turned it into a grow op. So inspecting things to make sure the property is still in an insurable condition. And the other side, and a lot of clients, they don't seem to appreciate this side of it, is when we inspect a property, we're not doing it to make your life difficult. We're doing it because we've got the expertise and the skills to tell you what you can fix now to avoid a problem later.
I have a question in general terms, Thomas. How is the value or replacement cost of a building structure determined in the eyes of an insurance company?
Okay, so we determine the replacement cost on a building. Generally, we use computer programs to calculate that, where we input the square footage of the building, the materials it's made out of. In the case of residential properties, the number of bathrooms, number of kitchens. There's really two types of programs. There's the ones for the residential properties, your single family, your duplexes, triplex, really a fourplex. And then there's the commercial tools that we use to evaluate the larger commercial buildings. Those are pretty accurate. And again, they're industry standard programs. So we're all using across Canada the same two or three computer programs for that to get the replacement cost. And the big thing here is, again, replacement cost has nothing to do with the real estate value of the house. Right? I like to use the example of a three-bedroom bungalow. It's a $500,000 house in Ottawa. It's a $7 million house in downtown Toronto. But at the end of the day, it's still going to cost us $330,000 to rebuild, regardless of where it's located.
And the important thing for our listeners to appreciate or try to understand is that an insurance company's estimate of value is based on the actual structure. Land does not dictate. The land is the land is the land. So at the end of the day, don't think because the insurance company has established a value that you feel is so much less than what the current market may hold. You know, there's a large land component that doesn't figure into the replacement costs because the land will be there whether the structure's there or not. Would that be a fair comment, Thomas?
Absolutely. And it works in reverse too. So there are properties I've seen where the amount that we're insuring it for to replace is higher than you're ever going to get if you sell it. And that's just the nature of the beast, right? Some markets have a really depressed real estate market. You can buy a really nice house for very little money, but it's still going to cost us a fair bit to replace it if it burns down.
Good point. Thank you. Thank you for that. Bernie.
If I go to buy a property or commercial space, does the amount of financing affect the way my premiums will work or what I'm going to be paying for insurance?
Yes and no. So if we're insuring a rental property, so you bought a single family rented property, if we're insuring it on the personal line side of the insurance industry, so the same type of policy that you would have on your own house, not having a mortgage could entitle you to a mortgage-free discount. Generally, once it's on the commercial side and we're dealing through the commercial department, having a mortgage or not having a mortgage doesn't have a huge impact on your price, but the type of mortgage can impact it. So there are some insurers out there that do not want to deal with properties that have non-standard financing. So if you're not doing a mortgage through a normal financial institution, they may not be willing to offer terms, or they'll offer terms that are a higher price or more restrictive. I mentioned earlier, there's that one property where the mortgages are six individuals doing a first mortgage on a property, and they're all insisting on being listed individually as first mortgages. That's not something that I can get an insurer to get on board with just because of the complexity and the likelihood of something going terribly wrong. So yes, your financing will impact your insurance, but not that much, provided we're sticking more or less to the standard stuff. And that can be private mortgages, that can be the mortgage investment corporations. I've got a couple of clients where their mortgages are coming from their own company. They've got a family trust. The family trust holds mortgages on all the properties. And it's not standard, but the insurance company, when you explain the situation, they goes, oh, the guy's lending himself money, and that's fine because it's really he's lending himself the money. So it's financing, but it's not. We're not going to worry about it.
Good point. But that interesting point. Thank you for that question, Bernie. that's something that, you know, again, because very often we're dealing with in the investment world with vendor take-back mortgages, which would fall into that category and may or may not have a bearing on the amount of insurance or the cost of the insurance that you're looking at. So that's a consideration I hadn't even really thought of. And it's a situation that comes up, you know, more often than not. So thank you. Thank you very much for that. So here's a question. Can rental income, whether it's residential or commercial, be insured against loss?
Absolutely. So there's coverage available for loss of rental income, and that coverage is triggered if an insured peril happens. So easy one to look at is fire, right? You've got a multi-unit residential that you're renting out, and you've insured your annual rental income. Say it's $30,000. You can pick your timeline. So usually it's 12, 18, and 24 months that you can pick for your timeline. And if there's a fire, you lose the property, the insurance company is going to pay your lost rental income for that time period, 12, 18, 24 months, or until the property is back and ready to be rented again. It's not an automatic coverage. So it is something a good broker is going to make it an automatic coverage, because we'll just ask you what your rents are and we'll include it. But it's something to review your policies. Make sure you have loss of income coverage, rental income coverage.
So can you arrange for loss of income coverage, even if you're renting out, let's say you're from one extreme, renting out a room in your home or renting out an in-law suite in your home as a separate rider to your homeowner policy? Is that possible? Can you do that?
Yes, and you might not even have to, depending on the policy you have on your home. So there are home insurance policies out there that do provide for coverage for your loss of rent for the part of your property that you were renting or holding out for rent. Your first step there is to review your own home insurance policy, see if the coverage is included in the wording. If it's not, it is something you can add by endorsement.
Thank you for that. Wonderful. Bernie.
So one of the things that some people have experienced with insurance companies is that they are slow to pay out on commercial losses. What's involved with an insurance company from their perspective, and why does it take time?
So first thing, and at this point, I want to make very clear to everyone, in Canada, the default assumption for insurance claims is pay it. So all of our adjusters are trained in this country. They want to pay your claim. But in order to do that, they first have to make sure that your policy was in force, that whatever happened was something that the policy was covering. And then they have to quantify the loss. And a lot of our delays that I find on commercial claims is on the client's end. So they're being asked for documentation and they're taking 60 days to get it to the insurance company. Or they're saying, well, you don't need to see that. And the reality is the insurance company, they're not asking you for things unless they need it to justify paying. I have seen commercial claims paid out in as quick as 7 days. And I've seen them take years. And it's just a matter of how quickly you're prepared to respond to the insurance company, and to be honest, how straightforward the claim is. So simple things like fires, floods, theft, that's a lot easier for us to adjust than some of the more complex stuff. I know if you just look at the news now, there's all the lawsuits regarding business interruption insurance and the COVID-19 pandemic, because that's complex. You know, a lot of insurance companies are saying that's not something we intended to insure. And a lot of people are saying, yeah, but your policy doesn't say it's not covered, so we think it is. And those claims, they're going to take years to sort out, because until a judge tells us who's right, we're not going to know who's getting paid.
So is that something that a client who is experiencing a loss and is your client, can they expect you to assist in the entire claim process?
So as a broker, we're not adjusters. We're not licensed to adjust losses. But again, our job is to give advice. I like it as we're in your corner. Our job is to be in your corner. Now, sometimes that means telling you, no, you're not going to get coverage for that. The insurance company's right. Here's why. My job is to give the bad news when I have to give the bad news. But during the claim process, I'm there to work with my clients, to help them through it, to explain the why. Right? They'll get an email from an adjuster saying, I need, you know, the last 6 months of your month-end statements, and I need your commercial lease, and I need your fire suppression system inspection reports. And that's all they're going to say. They're just going to give me this. You're going to go, why? Well, I know why. I can tell you why. So if you phone me and you talk to me, I can explain what they're looking for. It's, again, they're not trying to avoid paying. They're just trying to justify that the payment is due and how much they have to pay. I like to walk, I always say, beside my clients in a claim process. Right? I can't be out in front doing it for you because it's not my business. It's not my property. I can't answer a lot of these questions, but I'll be right beside you every step of the way to make sure you're treated fairly.
So would it be fair to say that you are sometimes in the position of being an advocate for your client by explaining to them that this is what and why the insurance company is asking for that information? Because I think a lot of people have the perspective, and I know this is a tough question, that they tend to take a look at a broker as being, and what you said is very, very important. Your client is the person that you're insuring, but very often, and unfairly, the insurance broker is kind of grouped in with the insurance company. And I can imagine that it has to put you in a difficult position. Is that a fair comment or observation? Do you ever feel that, Thomas? Or is it something that you really haven't experienced?
Brokers, we're walking a tightrope while juggling flaming batons. So We're in the middle. We're always between the company and the client. We work for our clients. The broker's responsibility is to their clients. So the way I like to look at it, I work with my insurance companies. I work for my clients.
Okay.
I never promise you like my answer. I'm going to tell you the truth. I will give you the right answer. I don't promise you have to like it, right? Because yes, the contract is the contract. Sometimes what the client expects is not what's going to happen. And the broker's job is to be the one to help deliver that news, because one, we know our clients. So I know how to talk to my clients a lot better than an insurance company does, because the insurance company doesn't know my client as well as I know my client. They don't understand necessarily that, you know, there was a fire in the house and the couch burnt down. Well, the insurance company goes, yeah, it's a couch, $1,000, it's a couch. I know that was great grandma's couch that they took from Iran when the Shah was overthrown and they came to Canada. So yeah, it's a couch. But there's the emotional side of you've lost a family heirloom, and I'm really sorry about that, but the best we're going to do is get you a new couch. It can be difficult. To be honest, I love it. That's the part of my job I like. I like being the guy who sits there in the middle and does the advising. I always say, you know, people look at insurance brokers, they go, oh, we're salesmen. We're here to sell you something. You know, sure, there are guys out there that exist to make a sale, but they tend not to stick around this industry very long, because the true job of an insurance broker is risk management and advice. And that's what we're here to do. We give you the advice, we help you manage your risk, and we're there to work with you through it. So I have some clients that are comfortable taking a lot of risk. So they buy very restrictive insurance policies because they don't care. Unless the place burns down, they're not going to call me. I've got other clients that buy every coverage I can possibly throw at them because they would much rather write a check for $10,000 a year and not have to worry about it. It's the balance that the insurance brokers do. We are ethically and professionally obligated to work on our client's best interest. That's what we're here for.
That's very comforting to hear. So again, you know, look at your insurance broker as being an ally, someone who'll work with you during these at times difficult situations.
If you look at your insurance broker and you don't trust every word that comes out of their mouth, find a new insurance broker immediately. Our entire job is based on trust.
Mm. Great
so
point.
If you can't trust the person you're working with, work with somebody else.
Great, wonderful point. I think that'll resonate really, really well with our listeners. I don't think I've heard a better bit of advice, quite frankly, coming from an insurance broker than what we've just heard. Wonderful. Thank you very much for that, Thomas. I have a bit of a softball to throw you. Last question. If a loss occurs, who is the first person the insured should contact? Outside of the fire department, police department, or any one of those services? Is it you?
I'm glad you said outside of the fire department. I had a client call me before he called the fire department.
Oh, really?
He didn't know who to call. He said, my house is on fire. What do I do? I'm like, well, is the fire department there? He goes, no, I didn't call them. Okay, great. Call them first. So that client's reaction should show you where I think they should call. Your first call should be to your insurance broker. You want to talk to us. One, it might not be something you want to advance a claim for. So yes, maybe you've had a flood, but when we talk about it and I get one of my contractors to come out and look at it, you find out it's $8,000 worth of damage. Maybe at $8,000, you'd rather write the check yourself than deal with the insurance company and the possibility of a rate increase next year. Hmm. Right? Particularly if you've got a $2,000, $2,500 or $5,000 deductible for water, why would you make a claim? And that's the type of thing we can spitball, we can talk about it. We can make a plan. If you talk to me first, I can phone the insurance company for you. So unless it's an emergency, like, you know, you're midnight on a weekend and you're in a car accident, yeah, phone the insurance company's after hours claim line. They've got staff to look after you immediately. But if it's not something that can't wait, talk to your broker first. because we are going to be able to help you work through the variables, work through the process, and help set your expectations. I was speaking to a client this morning. They had a hit and run accident over the weekend. They waited until Monday because, like, whatever, the car is drivable. I've got to make a police report. I'll phone Thomas on Monday. I spoke to them and we worked through it. We're going to put a claim in. I then phoned the insurance company and I'm the one that sat on hold for an hour and a half. So my clients have better things to do with their day than sit on hold.
Well, wow. Now there's a service that's well worth every penny you pay for insurance. That's wonderful, Thomas. That's good to hear. Wonderful. Thomas, this has been one of the most enlightening podcasts I think, you know, I've had the pleasure of participating in. And I want to thank you very much on behalf of our listeners for, you know, coming on in today and speaking to us all. If any of our listeners have any additional questions, would like to contact you, how do they get a hold of you? Now, your contact information will be on the podcast notes, but is there a preferred way? Can you share with our listeners your email address, for instance?
So my email address is thomaswatson@guardsman.ca, and that's thomaswatson @guardsman.
Wonderful.ca.
And I'm also quite happy to give my cell phone number out. I have a cell phone specific to being an insurance broker designed for people to call and text me on. So 613-697-6334. That comes directly to me 24 hours a day. I don't promise I'll respond at 3 a.m., but if you text me at 3 a.m., I'll answer when I wake up.
There we go. Wonderful. That's super. That is absolutely great. Thank you again, Thomas. Now it's time for...
It's time for the Property Wizard's Word of the Day.
So Thomas, we are going to ask you to provide our listeners with a definition of co-insurance.
I'm happy to. This is one of the most misunderstood concepts in insurance. So I'm not going to define co-insurance for you because the technical definition is useless to you as someone who owns an insurance policy. What you need to know is how it impacts you. Co-insurance is our way in the insurance industry of forcing you to properly insure your property. So generally, property losses are always going to be partial. It's very rare that we have a total building burned down. So the tendency as a person who wants to save money is, why would I insure my building for the $1 million it would take to replace when I know that realistically, probably only going to have $500,000 worth of damage at any point in time in most situations. So my gut reaction is, well, I'm going to go buy $500,000 insurance policy. And if I've got $500,000 claim, life is good. Co-insurance forces you to pay for part of the loss yourself if you do that. So we either use an amount of money. So it could be $1 million on $1 million building, or we'll use a percentage, 80, 90, or 100%. And what we're saying is you have to insure the property to that percentage of its total replacement value in order for coinsurance to not apply. And if coinsurance applies, you will then end up paying part of the loss yourself. So for a simple example, all right, let's say $1 million building with an 80% coinsurance clause on it. So to avoid a penalty, you have to insure your $1 million building for at least $800,000. So you insure the building for $800,000. It burns down. Your insurance company is going to write you a check for $800,000. They're going to say, you know what? It was insured to at least 80% of value. Here's the $800,000. Your building's still worth $1 million, but you didn't buy $1 million, so you don't get $1 million, right? You're on the hook for that $200,000 yourself. That's not a penalty. Where the penalty is you insure that building for 50% of its value. So you've got $1 million building, you've insured it for $500,000. If it burns down, you think, oh, I'm going to get my $500,000. Well, no, because you didn't insure it to the 80%, you're going to get a reduced payout. And the math we use is called did over should multiplied by the loss. So you did insure the building for $500,000. You should have insured it for at least $800,000. And then you multiply that by your loss, and your loss being $1 million. So when we take $500,000 divided by $800,000 multiplied by $1 million, you end up getting a value less. So you get roughly half of the insurance you paid for it.
Right.
So you have to pay some of that. So it's the insurance company's way of keeping the system fair, right? We base all of our prices on insuring things to full value. So in order to make sure the insurance companies collect enough money to pay their claims, they have to make sure people are insuring properties to their full value and not hedging their bets and hoping for partial losses all the time.
Ah, that's a really, really good point. That's a great explanation for something which I think I get a lot of questions about myself, and I've had a number of questions myself surrounding just this exact issue. So thank you very, very much for that. So thank you very much. Remember, you can save $250 on your next Gentry Learning course by using the phrase, all in capital letters, one word, podcast, P-O-D-C-A-S-T, when checking out. Be sure to use it. Real estate is for everyone. We can all do it. And there isn't anybody that I know that wouldn't benefit from an investment in real estate. If you have any questions, you know how to get a hold of us. Until then, remember, if there are no problems, there are no opportunities. Thank you all.
Thanks for joining Freddie on another edition of The Property Wizard. Got a question? Ready to invest? Email info@gentryres.com. And if you'd like to find out more about the courses offered through Gentry Learning, visit gentryres.com. Until next time, remember, if there are no problems, there are no opportunities.